This is the podcast for Monday, October 31st, 2011, Halloween. And so I thought we'd start out with like an ethical conundrum based on Halloween. So the question is, as a utilitarian, should you hand out Halloween candy to all the kiddies? And if so, how would you decide whether or not you should do that? But like what? So as a utilitarian, first of all, what is your standard of value? How are you deciding what to do?
Greatest good for the greatest
number. Greatest good for the greatest number. And how does that get cashed out? Like, what is good?
Pleasure.
And what creates pleasure?
Candy,
right, yeah. Yeah.
But later the cavities cause the opposite of pleasure.
Uh-oh, we got some long-term consequences, right? So as a utilitarian, you have to think, you know, broad scope. You can't just think, oh, I'll give candy to all these kids and it'll make them happy. You think, oh, well, you know. What? So the question is, how much do you contribute to tooth decay and maybe, like, you know, reinforcing bad habits of poor eating? Yeah.
Hand out candy and toothbrushes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, you can have it. Will the kids use the toothbrushes? Will they be likely to eat the candy and not use the toothbrush? Throw the toothbrush away? Don't they already have a toothbrush? Will giving them an extra toothbrush encourage them to brush them more?
I don't know if I ever got anything besides candy when I was little. I'm just
out. Or you try to trade it to one of your gullible friends or something like that,
yeah.
Right?
No,
it's a toy, you know? It's a cool toothbrush. Yeah, it's candy toothbrush. What else would go into your decision? So you have to think about, okay, candy tastes good, but maybe it's bad for your teeth. It might give you some cavities if you don't brush them. Now, what if you you gave out the candy and the day before you like set up a table out at like the cafeteria there about like the dangers of tooth decay. So, or maybe like you called your local elementary school, right? And you said, we need like, you know, tooth decay awareness month. So you like do something for kids' teeth and you give them the candy. So it kind of maybe bounces out or something.
You've been to a dentist, haven't you? They have the candy sitting down.
Tell you, those root canals. Actually, the root canal is fine. I think I mentioned this before. It's the stuff that comes before the root canal that's bad. Like the pain that you get the root canal to solve. Yeah.
As a utilitarian, would it be necessary to balance out the remote interaction activity?
Well, what are you doing? Like, when I'm talking about balancing out, like...
what we're doing here, I mean, it is a short-term pleasure that's relatively harmless.
Yeah.
It needs to be balanced with the dentist or handing out the toothbrushes or something. Or can a utilitarian just sort of take a short-term view and say, well, really it's not very harmful, no, real long-term, so I don't need to balance my activities, so I'm justified.
So it depends on how much total happiness or pleasure long-term you're going to produce. So you'd have to make a calculation in your mind. Okay, well, how much harm is it really going to do if kids eat candy for one night, right? And you might think, oh, also it's sort of a custom. Kids eat a bunch of candy on this one night, and maybe they get sick of it, and maybe they won't eat it for a while. Maybe they're like, oh, they think about candy, they're like, oh, my stomach hurts just thinking about another Milky Way, right? I mean, kids will do that, too. I remember when I was a kid, there was just some friends of mine, they would get an allowance of like $5. And they would take that $5, which was a lot of money back in like the 70s. They would go down to the 7-Eleven store and they would just buy candy. Like $5 worth of candy. And then they would eat it all by the time they'd like walk home and they would eat it all by the time they get home. So I mean some kids will overdo it. But you know, it's one night a week, so maybe you think, okay, it's fine. But then what else might you consider about giving away candy? What kind of values are you reinforcing on Halloween?
Don't throw eggs in my house.
Well, I suppose it's like extortion, right? So it's like, what does trick or treat mean? Trick means give me candy or I'll do something to your house, right? What kind of value system is that? That's sort of like, you know, give me more government benefits or I'll spray graffiti and shout slogans and wave my sign in front of your face or whatever, right? But I mean, think about this idea of like people going around to different people with your hand out, right, and saying, "Oh, please, please give me something," expecting them just to give you something, just because it's that certain time of day. And that's something you didn't earn, right? Going around begging for candy. What kind of values does that reinforce? And you might think, well, that's BS, because kids don't really think in that way. So maybe down in their subconscious mind. So a lot, you start thinking about it, it's a lot more involved than like, oh, should I give this piece of candy to these kids? There's like a larger context. What about all the sort of occult, associations and giving kids nightmares, feeding into the dark side of the human psyche or the spiritual world, if you believe in that? That might be something to consider. I was actually listening to a great show. It's called the Jesus Christ Show. It's on Sunday mornings. And it's this guy, basically it's like Jesus doing a call-in show. So this guy, he plays Jesus. And so you call him up with your problems. And he advises you as Jesus would. He starts out, he says, "I am your holy host." But he was talking about Halloween and whether or not Christians should participate in Halloween. It was a really interesting discussion. And he was just talking about the fact that it was a pagan holiday. It was sort of co-opted by Christianity, as was Christmas, as was Easter. And there's nothing, in his view, there wasn't anything wrong with it. And I suppose you could say, from a utilitarian point of view, you might say, well, if you're like going around shouting Halloween is the devil, people are going to think you're a nut and they're not going to listen to anything else you have to say. Or if you're taking like little Bible tracts and putting them in the little plastic pumpkins, people are going to think you're like a sort of weird. But if you like participate and maybe you send your kids out in biblical costumes, or you just smile and hand out candy and you sort of look normal and figure, well, it's all good fun and ghosts and goblins and stuff like that. It's just nobody, a lot of people that dress up those, they don't really believe in it. And nobody believes, like in the original Samhain tradition, you dress up as sort of these ghosts and goblins to scare away the evil spirits. Sort of idea of fighting fire with fire. But nobody believes that anymore. So you might see it's sort of harmless fun. So anyway, as a utilitarian though, you'd have to weigh all these different things and come to some conclusion. So then the question is, like, how much time should you spend thinking about whether you should give out Halloween candy? Well, I mean, are there other things that you could consider? I mean, I can think of five more. Well, what about all the getting up and answering the door, right? Get up, ring, 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 get up. Go. I mean, what are you're there, you're a slave to the doorbell for, 2 or 3 hours, right? What else could you be doing with your time? Yeah. Put the what? I'll put the bowling board. Yeah, I've done that before. I've done that and put like a little sign that says just take one.
But they always take all.
Yeah, so it works for a while and it works even better if people think they're being watched. If you like set up something and you like have one of those little hands that moves like from motion sensor or something and put a sign that says I'm watching you, then you get less thievery. But still, if you're out watching, all of a sudden you look out, you just put the candy out, it's all gone, right? So
you've got a system.
Yeah, I do. But it's like, and then like what else, what I mean, what else would you consider when you're thinking about whether this is a good idea or not? How about the money you spent, right? It might kind of cost money. What else could you have done with that money?
Bought candy for yourself.
You could have bought candy for yourself, right? What else could you... How could you maximize that? Suppose you spent $10 on Halloween candy. What else could you do with that $10 that would create even more happiness than giving candy away to middle and lower middle class children that live in your suburban tract home neighborhood?
Actually,
I suppose, yeah, but maybe you got food. In the U.S., we have food stamps and soup kitchens and Food for Lincoln County and Grassroots Garden, and we have all sorts of food charities around here. And if you're hungry, your family's hungry, talk to somebody on campus, they'll hook you up with a charity or even a government organization. There's lots of groups around here helping the people that don't have enough to eat. The main problem in America, the health problem amongst the poor, obesity. Because you get these, well, for all sorts of reasons, but it's not like, so can you think of another place where obesity isn't a problem? How about Somalia, right? The problem there is like maybe you have a belly, but it's because your stomach is like distended because it hasn't had anything in so long. Your ribs are sticking out, right? So you could take that $10 and maybe give it to Save the Children or one of these other groups like World Vision or Oxfam or one of these groups, right? And instead of giving fat kids candy that's going to rot their teeth, maybe make them a little happy. You could keep some kid from dying of starvation, from getting up calories. You help a kid have adequate nutrition so they don't go blind by the time they're an adult. Keep them from getting a preventable disease like malaria by just having like a $3 mosquito net over their bed at night. Yeah.
This is a devil's advocate, not actually what I believe, but aren't you prolonging their suffering?
Oh, it's a good question. So are you actually doing more harm than good by like feeding hungry people, or are they going to just multiply like sort of like feral cats? You start feeding the feral cats and all of a sudden you've got five. we'll get to that when we talk about Peter Singer, but there is this sort of thing about unintended consequences. You get this when you have like the government says, oh, well, let's set some new banking rules. And we'll tell the banks they can only charge so much as a percentage when people are using their debit cards. And what do the banks do? Well, you're going to have to pay to use your debit card. So before it was free, right? And the merchant was paying the fee to use the debit cards. And different debit cards had different prices. And so the merchants could choose like the lowest price for per transaction. And, you know, I've talked to some merchants around here, and they're, like, saying, you know, oh, we use this one because this one's lousy, and these guys charge too much, and these guys, they tell you it's going to be low, it's going to be high. So they can kind of shop around. But if the government sets the price, then all of a sudden they're like, hey, we're in the hole. We have to pick up this money. I know we'll have to charge our customers to use their bank cards. So then you're, like, paying $3, $5 a month to use your ATM card because the government's trying to help you. So there is a sort of law of unintended consequences. And the feeding feral cats is a good example of that, too. Or adopting a kitten, what have you. So instead of just thinking, like, particularly about what you could do in this one situation, a good utilitarian was going to have to think globally. What's going to be the long-term consequences of this? And so one of the objections to utilitarianism we'll see later is that it just, it's too complicated. It takes too long to calculate the consequences. But we'll see if that's really true. Let's see. We'll get this up here. Okay. I think we just finished talking about hedonism at a call. Oh, by the way, there's an extra credit assignment up on Moodle. You get 10 points towards your score, or your score that goes up to 70%, whichever is higher. So everybody can get 10, and then people that scored, you know, like really low, like in the 50s, will still get up to 70, so you can do better on the next exam, maybe go pass, no pass, something like that. You're not totally sunk in the class. They are not. So on this next exam, you might have to know something like, is egoism, is it an absolutist theory or a relativist theory? Or is utilitarianism, is it a relativist theory or an absolutist theory? So I'm asking you some questions, but that'll be material that's sort of about utilitarianism. It won't be. I won't ask you define absolutism or define relativism, or I won't ask you any particular questions about subjectivism. So it will be. They'll be specifically about the new material. But sometimes the new material will sort of bring in some of the old material. Like if you're dealing with an absolutist theory, you need to know what an absolutist theory is. And actually, with utilitarianism, this really helps. If you remember, utilitarianism is an absolutist theory that says it's always your moral obligation to do which creates the most happiness for the whole wide world. Then you'll get those questions which calling you to understand those, you'll get those correct. Whereas if you think about it, utilitarianism as a kind of a relativist theory where what the right thing to do depends on the situation, you might get confused. because although what will create the most happiness sometimes does depend on the context, the principle never changes. The principle, your moral, there's only one moral rule in utilitarianism. It's maximize happiness. The means doesn't matter. It's the end or the result that counts. That's why it's a consequentialist theory. So it's an absolutist theory because it says you don't have a choice not to maximize happiness if you want to be a good person, a moral person. You always have to maximize happiness. But what's going to maximize happiness in one situation isn't going to maximize happiness in another situation. Like pulling somebody over for speeding is... I don't know about that. Maybe that's a controversial example. Pulling someone over for driving, 90 miles an hour might be something which would maximize happiness, right? If you're a police officer. But when you pull the person over and they're going to see their dying mother, or there's like a woman in the back seat or out ready to give birth, and the hospital's like two blocks away, maybe providing a police escort and not filing charges would be the thing that would maximize happiness. Whereas maybe writing a ticket to like a teenager with a lead foot, might be the best thing to do in the former situation. So it depends on what the circumstances are sometimes. But the principle, maximize happiness, that isn't relative. It doesn't change depending on what culture you're in. The Chinese people have to maximize happiness in the same way that the Arab people have to maximize happiness, the same that the European people have to do it. So the principle is always the same, but the circumstances might say that what you should do in that situation might change. Any questions about that? I need to find a better way. See, this is not maximizing happiness. I find a better way to call up my PowerPoint instead of typing it up here. All right.
I can write you an index page.
I could do that. I need a bookmark here. Maybe I just put a bookmark here. But I think the deep freeze kills all that stuff when you do that with a computer. All right.
So it would automatically draw the files.
Right, but then I'd have to. I suppose I could just put it on my homepage or something. I'll figure it out. Actually, I could have gotten in Moodle, but then I have to type in my L number and PIN. Interestingly enough, utilitarianism relies on a lot of pragmatic or practical judgments. Because think about it, a lot of the values are really easy, right? What's a value? Happiness or pleasure? How much do I want? As much as possible, right? Okay, there, I'm done, right? I don't have to think about principles. I don't have to think about, like Kant has this sort of long-winded sort of flowchart way of doing, okay, try to imagine a world where everybody did it, or am I treating people as ends in themselves? No, you just think, I'm going to try to make a bunch of happiness as much as I possibly can. Yeah.
You said do you want happiness. Do you mean you personally wanting happiness, or do you mean as a whole everybody needs to have happiness?
Oh, so to be a moral person, no. If you're acting as a moral person, then you're trying to produce as much happiness as possible. So Mill would say it's your moral obligation to maximize happiness.
For everybody.
You're right, and not just for yourself.
All right.
So otherwise, you would just be, you would be, what would you be actually? Would you still be a consequentialist if you wanted to maximize happiness only for yourself?
No, you'd be an egoist.
Is egoism a form of consequentialism?
Yeah.
Well, what does egoism say? Egoism says you should act in your self-interest, right? So you act in your self-interest some of the time? So yeah, all the time. And should you, if you have a choice between maximizing your interest a little and maximizing a lot, which one, or fulfilling your interest some and fulfilling it a lot, which you're going to pick?
A lot.
Yeah, a lot, as much as possible, right? So I think about egoism as a consequentialist theory, but it says that you should maximize your own individual self-interest. utilitarianism says you should maximize the interests of everyone. I mean, Mill's kind of vague about this. He sometimes uses the phrase "everyone concerned" or "all concerned," which is kind of, well, do I have to think about everyone all the time? And I think he thinks that you should think about the general good of society. But sometimes when you're acting in a particular context, it doesn't really make sense to think about, like, global civilization, right? If I'm trying to figure out what might be some, like, really particular situation that really doesn't have much implication for global civilization. Now, it's kind of hard to think of because, like, every little thing, you think, oh, should I have a cup of coffee? Well, is it you know, shade grown? Is it fair trade coffee? Is it, you know, you start down that road, right? So, I think an example. Well, like if I'm trying to decide whether or not I should eat lunch now or eat it later, right? So it doesn't even speak to when I'm going to eat. I can think, well, I can eat lunch before class and I might get a little sleepy, but maybe if I drink some coffee, I'll be okay, and I won't be sort of nagged with the hunger pangs in the middle of a lecture. Or I could eat after class and then be able to relax a little more and digest better. And you sort of weigh these. You don't think about how does this affect the world. You're just thinking about your own particular case. But now if you're thinking about whether you want to eat like a nice juicy steak or, you know, or maybe something. So suppose you're thinking about getting like a burger and you're thinking about that versus thinking about like going over to the vegetarian thing where they have like the tempeh and the tofu and all that stuff and vegetables. I mean, then you might think more globally, like, well, how is this burger produced? And that's like a relevant moral consideration. Whereas like when you eat, you know, it's just something that really doesn't affect other people. I suppose you might think it might affect the line, the traffic or something, but really that's more of an effect on you. If you go at a later date, maybe it will be less of a line. That might be a reason not to do it. But if you're thinking about what to eat, then all of a sudden you get more sort of regional or global issues about your effect on the environment, your effect on your health, that sort of thing. So, okay, I think we covered this last time. Oh, we talked about the experience machine. We just left off on higher and lower pleasures. So, just to review, the higher pleasures are the intellectual and cultural pleasures. So they're the pleasure of going to the art museum, of looking at a painting. Today in my photography class, we saw a documentary on a French photographer, which was, you know, kind of interesting, but not probably as interesting as like watching The Walking Dead or going to like the... I went to Hysteria City, the haunted house, the big one on Springfield, and that was like a lot of fun, right? And I compare like the pleasure I got from going to the Hysteria City versus the pleasure of watching this French documentary. Our documentary on a French filmmaker. I think the Hysteria City thing was a little more fun, but I also think that the French photographer video was also enjoyable, and I think it was more worthwhile. So the question is, could you think that as a utilitarian? And the objection to Mill is that it's a philosophy only fit for swine. Let's see. Have that on here someplace? Maybe not. So the objection is that it's this crass hedonistic philosophy. What they would say is it's a philosophy fit only for swine. And the idea is that if you're a utilitarian and you're just trying to be a hedonist, so what do you want to do? Go have sex with anything that moves, wallow in the mud, get drunk, go down to the pub and sing drinking songs while you drink yourself under the table, gamble, right? All the sort of... base bodily pleasures that have to do with excitement, maybe go to like a rooster fighting contest, place a bet on it, boxing, right, stuff like that. Today we have like professional wrestling, Jersey Shore, you know, sort of the really, you know, Jerry Springer type stuff. I'm trying to think of what is there some awful talk show that I haven't that's like I'm just trying to think, what's the worst thing on TV today? Lowest common denominator. Can you think of anything?
The worst thing on TV today?
Like the lowest of the low. This just appeals to like the most base, ugly part of human nature, and it's just like awful. No artistic value.
I don't know about on TV, but Howard Stern on the radio.
Howard Stern, right.
I mean, it's not the lowest of the low, they just talk about it.
I suppose he's kind of crass, right? But I mean, he also talks about sort of political and social issues and stuff like that too. So maybe it's balanced out.
But swearing and
grammar. Yeah. Well, then the question is like, you know, is it? I'm trying to think. Like, so there was this interview with Stephen King, and he was saying all this stuff about art and about writing. And Stephen King, even though he writes these horror books, he's a really great writer, and he's an intellectual. I mean, he's a smart guy, and his books are very literary in their delivery. Now, the subject matter is popular, but the form is literary. And particularly, like, the last few books he's written, it's been literary subject matter, too. And a lot of people, they read, like, Carrie or something, they pick up one of these new books, they're like, this is like, you know, something I have to read for my English class. And I was thinking about this interview where it said that he was profane. He was relaxed, garrulous, and profane, according to the article. By the way, if you're reading an article that has the word garrulous in it, would you think that would be a higher or lower pleasure? How many people know what garrulous means? It means like talkative, like a person sort of gabby. Yeah, it means the same thing as verbose. What's verbose mean, right? So like having an expanded vocabulary, it causes you to have to look up words, or you use like words that people don't normally use, not like, and words that like you're down, like, you know, down with the lower classes, and they have no idea what you're talking about. That's for Mill, that's a higher pleasure. Now, it's not because I know what it means and you don't. Ha, 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 ha. I mean, Mill says you need to take these the intellectual pleasures and bring them down to the people. He's a utilitarian. So he says introduce people in the ghetto to art, music, and literature so they can appreciate it too. And he thinks it's all sort of conditioning. He doesn't believe that, you know, people are born intellectual, or that there's like such a thing as like, you know, aristocratic. So anyway, the higher pleasure are the intellectual culture ones, and then the lower pleasures are the kind of physical ones, and they have to do with these sort of lower base visceral emotions. They have to do with like sex and like sort of low brow humor, you know, something like the Vegas wedding thing, the Hangover, right? Dumb and Dumber, the Three Stooges, lower pleasures, right? You know, physical comedy. And then like something like what would be like an example of like what would be a comedy that would be sort of a might be a higher pleasure? Like think about like a satirical movie, like think of someone that's really fun. A Fish Called Wanda. Or the Life of Brian or something, yeah.
Wag the Dog.
Wag the Dog. Okay, yeah, so it's a sort of political movie, right? I'm trying to think of... But there are these, like, satirical movies that have, like, really... I mean, Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day is kind of iffy. I guess that would be a popular movie. It's got a lot of interesting themes in it. And it's sort of a great story, but maybe that one. But I'm thinking about like the movie Brazil. It's sort of like a weird kind of offbeat highbrow movie, and it's satirizing sort of bureaucratic culture. And you know, it's a funny movie, but if you don't understand like politics, you're not going to get like the gags. Like, why is it funny that Robert De Niro is a renegade air conditioning repairman, right? Who's like, you know, instead of waiting for your government approved air conditioning guy to come, he like comes there and fixes your air conditioner for free and moves on to the next job, you know. But what's funny, if you've ever had to deal with government bureaucracy, you sort of can get that. But it's, you know, it's kind of on a higher plane. It's not like watching some guy get hit in the crotch, right, and laughing or slipping on a banana peel. Okay, so Mills, So some objections to Mill. So, and I get a lot of this in the got a lot of this, these objections in the forum. It's elitist. It's classic. It's ethnocentric. Ethnocentric is one of those buzzwords, which I'm sure if you haven't been exposed to yet, you will be exposed to. It means kind of being looking at things through your own cultural lens, not understanding that other cultures have different ways of looking at things. But Mill says that, look, he's not being elitist at all. He says these things are objectively valuable. Some pleasures are better than others. And we need to introduce more of these higher pleasures to the lower classes. And so he was a big advocate of education and, like some of these programs they have, like bringing classical music to the inner city and some of these private schools that offer scholarships to at-risk youth and so on. Mill would be all in support of those sorts of things. There's a great movie called Conroy. It's about this guy whose name was actually Conrack. And he is this white, Southern school teacher who goes off as sort of idealist. He has an idealistic streak in him. He goes off and becomes a teacher in this district, which is all poor black kids living in this isolated island. And he introduces them to art, music, and literature. He and there's this one great scene where he's playing Flight of the Bumblebee. And sort of introducing to like sort of what classical music is all about, and he teaches about great literature and painting and history and so on. And that movie is really inspirational. And this idea that you want to spread these higher pleasures to other people, which is very much in the spirit of Mill. Oops. And so there's another argument that what you enjoy really depends on what you're used to. And so this is this idea, it's just a matter of habituation, that there aren't higher and lower pleasures, it's just that Mill is used to these sort of certain kinds of pleasures. But they're not more pleasurable, they're just the kind of ones that Mill likes because he's an elitist snob, I guess is the argument. Maybe this is just another version of the first one. But Mill makes this argument, I don't know whether it's a good argument or not. So do you think that people who are familiar with art, literature, music, painting, so on, are more, do they prefer higher pleasures? Yeah, it seems like sometimes they do. Like I noticed that the people, like if they have a choice between, so if you have a person who's actually, seen a good movie, and they're like looking at Dumb and Dumber or something like that, they might scan by and say, "Oh, I think I'll watch a foreign film," right? So I don't know. So, but it might be. I mean, a lot of people that have education sometimes they like the base pleasures. So I'm not sure they would always prefer them, or even maybe gravitate towards them. But at least they'd want a mixture of the two, and they wouldn't only focus on the lower pleasures. Whereas a person who is never exposed to the higher pleasures is going to tend to see them as weird, alien, and not be interested in them. Yeah.
I think the reasonable argument for Mel would be that the more education you have, the more options to experience and decide whether something has more value or not.
That's good. More options. And so there's three objections to utilitarianism. One is that it's too demanding. Let's just talk about that one to start out with, I guess. So the too demanding, remember we were talking about the Halloween candy, and you're thinking, well, what if you sent that money to starving children overseas? Wouldn't that be better? Well, why just $10? Why not $20? Why not $50? How much should you give? Well, how much do you got? And then, what do you spend money for? Well, like, I actually, so when I went out to Hysteria City, I actually treated five other people to tickets. The tickets are kind of pricey. They're like $20. But I was able to go through this half-price Eugene thing on one of the local radio stations KUGN, 590 AM. And I got four tickets for the price of one. So that was kind of cool. So they were like $5 a ticket for me. So that was pretty cool. And then one of the guys wanted to bring his girlfriend along, and so I said, I'll pay for half. So I was into it $30, but I got to go with a bunch of friends. I wanted to go anyway, so I would have gone by myself anyway. And so I created some happiness. But what if I would have taken that $30 and sent it to World Vision or one of these other famine relief organizations? So how much happiness would I have created if I would have done that? And then what is there more that I could do to make other people happy, not just myself? Maybe try to make myself a little less happy, or at least not focus on myself and make other people happy. What could I do? What might I do today that would bring more happiness into the world?
Skip a meal and send the price of that meal to somebody.
Yeah, so that might be something, right? Just not eat, right? So you're a little hungry, but somebody else is being fed. Yeah.
Does keeping yourself healthy and happy contribute to you being able to make other people happy later?
Okay, well, there you go. So if I'm like, you know, always miserable, thinking, oh, I'm so hungry, maybe I can't focus on my work, maybe I'm grouchy, maybe I snap at people, right? So you have to take that into consideration too. How about like if I just eat something that's cheaper? Because you can sort of get used to things over time. So like maybe like rice and vegetables, cook more. And think about, like, what's the utility of going out and spending, like, $4 on a cup of coffee at Starbucks, right? You think about, like, if you did that every day for a year, yeah, I mean, you'd be in Starbucks, like, $1,200. Think about what you could do with $1,200, right? You could probably save a village for that. I mean, usually it costs, like, something like that. I think that the number thrown around that the organization's pitch is, like, you know, $25 to $30 a month to sort of feed, clothe, house, and educate a child. So that's, you know, that's not very much, right? So think, I don't know, when I was 30 into 1200, how, what does that go? 40?
If you were to buy Starbucks $4, 365 days a year, you could fund a kid to live 58 days.
58 days, that doesn't sound
right. Yeah.
If it's $30,
you said $25 a day.
Yeah.
Yeah, 58 days. So $25 a month.
No, $25 a month.
365 times four.
Sorry, $25 a month.
$25 a month. Okay.
Buy it's really cheap. Like your gruel, grass hut.
It's 58.
Dig a well.
58 months and a half.
Yeah, so like 5 years, something like that, right? So 5 times 12, 16 months, about 5 years, right? So you think, so if I go without my daily Starbucks for a year, I could save 5 children for a year or something, right? So then you make these calculations, you're thinking, oh, I'm being an immoral person by going to the movies, buying CDs, getting a computer. Maybe I should just sort of like live in a yurt, maybe in Altenbaker Park, just to be down with the OWS protesters there. Just kind of hang out, live in my yurt, wave my sign, and maybe go around panhandling for money for overseas famine relief. Well, we'll get to Peter Singer later on, and he talks about, I mean, he didn't say you should go that far, but he says you sort of push in that direction. So one of the things people say about utilitarianism is it's too demanding. That any moral theory that says you have to sacrifice all your goals, projects, and all the little things that make you happy in order to help other people requires too much. Something's got to be wrong with that theory. So that's the too demanding theory, part of the theory. And then there's another objection, which is that it's too permissive. So somebody want to tell me what's a too permissive objection? Any thoughts on that? So what does it mean?
You can rationalize most anything clearly.
Oh, there you go. So think about the following scenario. So you're a doctor at a hospital. You've got 5 patients who need organ donations. If they don't get them by the end of the week, they're goners, right? You got somebody, and maybe you got some pretty valuable people. Maybe Steve Jobs is in your wing, right? He really needs another liver transplant. And if he sticks around a few years, he's going to invent some cool stuff, okay? And then maybe you got a person that runs like like some sort of a charity who's really good at helping people. And maybe you have like an artist, and maybe there's a couple of ordinary people there too. But they're all like, you know, valuable human beings. They're not criminals. They do good in the community. They have skills that benefit society, and they're suffering, and they're going to die if they don't get a transplant. And then you have this college student comes in, and he went binge drinking again. He's young, so he's sort of versatile. So his liver's actually okay because he's only been binge drinking for the 3 months he's been away from home. And he got behind a car and killed a couple of people and wrapped his car around a tree, right? And so he's going to go to prison, right? And maybe he's got all sorts of character problems, and he won't listen to authority, and he can't control his impulses. He doesn't have any friends because he's like a miserable so-and-so, right? So just everything about this guy, he's just like a total loser. And so you think, if I just put like a little air bubble in, you know, when I administer the anesthetic, when I'm going to work on him, I have like two eyes, I got a liver, a heart, some lungs, and I could redistribute all these organs to these to these people that really need them, right? And what is the world going to be any worse off with this guy? Probably not. Right? So then the question is, like, as a good utilitarian, should I do it? What do you think?
Well, but there's hospital costs for somebody sitting in the hospital for many times the amount of all those organs.
Okay, so that's the what they call the publicity requirement. So you have this. The problem there is that it seems that if you get caught, it's going to be really bad. Right? So somebody could sue the hospital. What else might happen as a consequence?
Is he the same blood type as the man?
Okay, so it might be like, suppose that he's a match for those five people. I mean, you got a lot of people waiting for organs. Something like 40,000 people. You have like 40,000 people die every year waiting for organs. So it's like a lot of people are. I think maybe there's 40,000 people on the waiting list, and 13,000 die every year. So it's a large number of people die because they didn't get the organ. And so, so you think it's just one? Yeah, one dies, and I kill one, and five live, or I let one live and five die. Just look at the numbers, right? It seems pretty obvious what I should do. And maybe I should just make sure I don't get caught. So. Just kind of make sure I'm not going to do this like every week, right? Maybe I'll wait for that perfect opportunity to do it once every few years. Maybe before I'm about to move to another hospital, get a promotion or something like that, right? So nobody's going to ask too many questions. So why wouldn't I do that? Assuming I think that I could get away with it. So I calculate the risk in with it, right? I think, okay, well, I have a certain chance of getting caught, and I have a certain chance of getting away with it. And I'd say when the chance is like so low that it's almost negligible, it seems like I'd want to do it, right? Or what do you think? How many people here would do that?
Well, if I were a good utilitarian.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So you think that... So I mean, this is so why now? Why is this? Why would this be a problem for utilitarianism? Let me ask that. Why might this be an actual argument against utilitarianism?
All the happiness that would be taken away from his friends and family.
Well, actually, might be an argument in favor of utilitarianism, yeah. Because the utilitarian might say, look. You can't just think of it. You have to think about all the effects of this guy's family, right? But then what? What else do you have to think about?
Times five, good.
There you go, right? So anything you could say about this guy, what if he gets his act together and discovers a cure for cancer, right, or whatever? Well, first of all, you have to think about the probability. Yeah.
I think maybe one argument would be that there have to be some guidelines and laws for the system to work even for a utilitarian. So an argument against it might not be. You have to have some law that you just can't break. Whether it's feel like it, or else the system won't.
Well, but you're not changing the system. You're just thinking about yourself and what you should do.
But I'm just thinking within the system.
Mm-hmm.
You asked an argument against it, and I'm just suggesting that if you do that, if you rationalize whatever you want, then how can there be any set law for anything? How do you make rules that are agreed upon to abide by if they can rationalize away whatever somebody chooses to?
There's a difference between what's illegal and immoral. So it might be illegal, but the idea is you do it anyway.
Right, but within the system, don't you have to hold to something that's legal and yet prohibit you from making a choice within that system?
Why would you necessarily?
I'm within the system. Doesn't the utilitarian think that there has to be at least some law?
Well, utilitarian might say that law has, like, utility, it has usefulness. But it doesn't mean that law is good in every case. So, like, I mean, it was illegal to not ride in the back of the bus, right? So, and it was illegal to hide Jews in your basement in Nazi Germany.
Okay, so is it, when it comes to a law, for utilitarian, it's pointless? Well, maybe not.
Whether you should follow the law in any given situation depends on what the long-term consequences are and how much happiness it will produce. If following the law, like, think about a case like, I mean, actually, this is a good case of utilitarianism. So if you think about, can you think of a case where maybe not enforcing the law in a particular case might be the best thing, or where breaking a law might be bring about the best consequences? Yeah.
You already said one earlier, speeding to get somewhere.
Yeah, there was a case I read about some football player. I can't remember his name, but he got a call that his mother-in-law was, like, going to die in the hospital. They're rushing down there. It's 2:00 in the morning. He gets an intersection. He looks both ways. He can see, like, I mean, you can see 100 yards either way. Looks this way, looks this way. The light is red. His mother-in-law is dying. He's got his wife with him and another family member. And so after looking carefully, he, you know, goes through the red light. So this cop pulls in behind him, and he's, like, a block from the hospital. So he's, like, you know, just keeps on driving and drives a block to the hospital and stops and is going to explain to the officer. And the officer's, like, screaming in his face and, like, at one point, like looks like he's going to pull out his gun. And he, like, cuffs the guy. And this guy's sitting in the squad car while this guy's on his radio while his mother-in-law is dying. Luckily, the family got to go into the hospital. I would say that was, like, even though it was illegal to do what he did, enforcing that law in that particular situation was a bad idea. It didn't produce the most happiness. And there was no reason to do it, even though that was the law. But then, so most people would say, okay, I agree with that. But then, well, what about when you could save 5 people by killing this one miserable so-and-so? You know, then why wouldn't you do it? And it might not be that, I mean, I've made this example so the guy, like, really, you know, is kind of a detriment to society. But maybe he's just some average college student. He's going in there to get his appendix out or his tonsils out or something like that. Never had his tonsils out. Some routine procedure. Oh, you know, freak thing with the anesthetic, you know, little air bubble. We don't know why these things happen. Even if he's just like an average Joe, if you compare his life with the 5 others, you're still going to come out up 4, right? All other things being equal. Even if you think about each of those 5 people and the 6 that you kill are equally valuable, it seems like, well, okay, it's 1 versus 5, right? So you kill 1, 5 live, you're up 4. And that's what utilitarian would say. All other things being equal, you should do that. It seems, anyway. After you've calculated in the possibility of getting caught and what the fallout for that would be. But then it seems like you could say, well, just don't get caught. Yeah.
So, I mean, kind of as a devil's advocate argument, what about overpopulation?
Okay, so saving lives, I assume, is okay, but maybe you think, well, what about overpopulation? So, I say, as a good utilitarian, you'd study population, and you'd realize that every industrialized country, every first world nation has a negative population growth if you don't count immigration. And so population is a problem. And I think Singer talks about this a little bit. Overpopulation is only a problem where technology is low and the birth rate is high. So as societies industrialize, the birth rate drops. And so that's one reason why globalization is a good thing, because it leads to industrialization of the third world. Birth rate drops. You get production, so you have ways of feeding more hungry people. Yeah?
Birth rates drop if people live longer.
Yeah, but so that's true that people do live longer, but the birth rate is a lot more important than lifespan, because people don't live that much longer. They don't live twice as long. Fewer of them die in infancy. What's that?
It's about twice as long.
Average lifespan goes up. Usually what happens is a whole bunch of people die before they reach the age of 5 or 6 years old. But if you look at like maximum lifespan, you'll find a lot of people who are like reached, 80 years old and in the third world, sometimes even more than in the U.S., because they eat a subsistence diet of like roots and vegetables, and they don't get cancer and have all the, and they're not overweight and so on. So, but I mean, you have to count that into your calculation. So whatever that number is, but the birth rate is huge, because even if people are living twice as long, if you have a birth rate of like say, 8 children per family, I mean that's like a huge birth rate. If you bring that down to 2. Then that's going to be a lot more difference than just people living another 40 years. So, overpopulation, I suppose, you have to think about that in the general calculus. Overpopulation is generally, though, just a problem in the third world. Although, as a utilitarian, you might say, well, if I have a child, that means I can't adopt a child from Ethiopia, and so maybe I'm doing something wrong, right? So you could... Or if I have a child, all the money I spend on this child, toys, clothes, diapers, health insurance, right? I could be sending that to Somalia or Bangladesh or someplace. Or I could take one of those children and adopt them myself. So that's all something you have to calculate. Again, the too demanding objection seems like it rears its ugly head here and says, well, any theory that says that it's wrong for you to have your own children, there's got to be something wacky with it. But then if you think about the fact that children are dying every day and nobody's doing anything about it, or some people are doing things about it but not enough, and that you could do something about it by making that change, then the argument seems more persuasive. But we're talking about the too permissive argument. So the too permissive argument, let's see if my PowerPoint dropped up here. Why is it not appearing? And I might just scroll on the board here. The server's not updating for some reason. Oh, that's why. Darn PCs. Where's the reload button?
It's just that top.
It's going to the right.
To the right?
Yeah. You want the refresh?
Yeah.
Come back this way to the left.
Right. Oh, this thing here?
There you go.
Here it is. I said in the Windows thing instead of Control. Okay. Here we go. All right, that's what I want. Current slide. All right. So there's. Can somebody turn down the lights here? In the back here, it's kind of washed out. I'm sorry, what?
Are you going to download these?
Yeah, I'll put these on Moodle. So, too permissive. So, this idea that you're required morally to kill innocent people seems like it's kind of a problem, right? So, and the argument is any moral theory which says that it's your obligation sometimes to kill innocent people has a problem with it. so there's two ways to respond. One way is what's called biting the bullet. And biting the bullet means you just basically say, yeah, so what? Or you say, okay, it's true that my theory has this implication, but if you really think about it, it makes sense. And so you try to defend it as is. So you say, well, look, five people are going to die. Those five people have equally valuable lives as the first person, or maybe they have a more valuable lives. Do those people deserve death any less than that one person? I mean, suppose those five people there through no fault of their own. Maybe a genetically inherited disease, maybe a freak accident that they couldn't have anticipated. So it's not like they're blameworthy. So it's not like, what's his name, David Crosby, who's ruined his liver through excess drinking and wants a liver. Steve Jobs didn't do anything to get pancreatic cancer, except for go on a macrobiotic diet and try to treat it through quack health theories instead of going for surgery right away. And he probably would have been saved if he would have done that. So, Chalk went up for slash and burn and went against Mexican yams or whatever is supposed to short cartilage or all the quack theories that people think. Chalk went up for modern science, and it's too bad that Steve actually in his biography talks about this and says he regrets not getting treatment right away because it's one of those rare forms of pancreatic cancer that could have been treated. And again, that's part of calculating the consequences, right? When you're calculating the consequences, you have to be coldly rational. You have to figure out what causes what. What's likely to bring about the outcome that I desire? And there is a case where he cooped up. The other thing you do is try to show that there will be some negative side effects or long-term consequences for doing this really bad thing. So there'll be some... what would happen if the hospital... is found to be killing patients. Well, not only is that doctor going to probably go to prison, and not only will everyone be deprived of, like, the years of, his medical training and all, the student loans he took out and all the residency, think about all the time and energy that went into his education, maybe from the time he was in kindergarten. And then the state's going to have to pay $30,000 a year to support him in prison because he'll probably, get life in prison. So, I mean, that's, a big amount of harm. So the idea is that even though there's a small chance of getting caught, the consequences are so bad that it wouldn't make sense to chance it. There's also cascading consequences about people's attitude towards hospital. Maybe if I have a pain in my side, I'm like, oh, I don't know what this pain in my side is. I hope it's not appendicitis. I hope my appendix isn't about to burst and spread, infection throughout my body and give me blood poisoning and kill me. But I just read in the paper yesterday that some guy went in there to get his tonsils out and they killed him to take his organs. Well, I'm not going to go to the hospital. I'm just going to tough it out and hope for the best. And so you might have people with preventable diseases or easily treatable cures that are freaked out by the story and they're staying away from hospitals. So there could be some generalized bad effects. Plus even the fear that you might create in people. Fear is a negative emotion. It's going to be splashed all over the media. That's going to be a negative consequence. So... you can do this with another case. There's a case of the drifter hanged. So you have some drifter wanders into town and a murder is committed. Like a small girl is killed. And so the townspeople want blood and they're really upset. Nothing like this has ever happened in their town before. They're frightened. And they want justice. So suppose the sheriff knows that the real killer's gotten away, he's gone to another jurisdiction, maybe he's told people who to look for, who he thinks the suspect is. Meantime, he's got the town to deal with. If he tells them that the guy's gotten away with it, they're going to be upset, and they might be worried that he's going to come back. And so there's this drifter that came to town, nobody really knows him, he's an alcoholic, he's kind of mean, and nobody likes him. Not very happy. So the idea is you frame this guy up for murder, make him the patsy, and all of a sudden the people rest easy, you hang in the town square, have a big party, everybody's happy again. So then as a utilitarian, why wouldn't you do that?
Is that the result of
well, but suppose you can't resolve the true problem. And telling the people the truth is not going to make them happy. They want somebody hanging from the end of that rope. They want to know that they can leave their windows open at night or whatever. They want justice. So the idea is you give the people what they want. Maybe there's like angry mobs of people going around, and maybe they're like accusing their neighbors of being child slayers. And maybe things are getting hound hand, you're getting like an angry mob, people are panicking. Just things are getting out of control. You need to do something. And if you tried making a speech and they wouldn't listen to you. So then the idea is you just frame up this poor sap that came through. His life is barely worth living, and you think about his life, which is just, you know, this much compared to the good of all the townspeople, right? Well, sheer numbers shows you that you just, you know, bump off this guy in a kangaroo trial and frame him up for murder. So what the utilitarian might say, though, is that the long-term consequences of doing something like that never pan out. So in fact, it leads to corruption. Maybe the sheriff's going to think about framing other innocent people, maybe being suspects, right? So you think about if the sheriff starts doing things of this sort, it's going to lead to a pattern. It's not just going to be a one-time deal. And so it's good not to even go down that road. So I think the utilitarian can go two ways. They can either say you should hang the innocent guy or kill the one to save the five, or he might say something like, well, look at the long-term consequences. It never makes sense to harm innocent people for the benefit of others. So we talked a little bit about the publicity requirement. So the kind of wrinkle here is that if you say, well, think of long-term consequences, the long-term consequences only happen if you get caught. So there's this kind of weird thing is that if you do it and nobody finds out about it, it's good. But if you get caught, it's bad. And that's all the publicity requirement is. It just says, in order for there to be long-term negative consequences, in many cases, the only difference is whether you get caught or not. In order for there to be these long-term negative consequences, people have to know about it. So then why not just do it in secret? Just make sure nobody finds out about it. And this is something like the anti-utilitarian would say, to say, oh, you can't say that it's never in the good of society. It's never in the interest of society to harm innocent people for the greater good, because you can do that a lot. You just have to keep it quiet. And I suppose you could sort of say, just don't get caught. So it's this kind of back and forth argument about whether or not the long-term consequences are going to be enough to say you shouldn't do bad things to innocent people. Now, how about this? Suppose, take another case. Let's take like the terrorist case in the book. Let's see what I got here. So think about I think I've got that on here. Maybe I got this. Rejoinder, just don't get caught. Oh, we talked about too demanding already. I think I've got the list of actually, let's talk about some of these objections. And we'll get to the terrorist case in a minute. So another objection is that utilitarianism it's impractical. You think about like the simplest decision you make, you wake up in the morning. What might be some decision you make in the morning?
Whether or not to eat breakfast.
Whether or not to eat breakfast, right? And what to eat for breakfast, right? So you think, okay, well, if I don't eat breakfast now, maybe I'll get to school a little earlier, I'll get a better parking space, but then maybe I'll be hungry, and then maybe I'll pay inflated prices in the cafeteria for food that's not healthy, but it tastes really good. So you like go back and forth like, oh, I'd literally have to have some eggs and bacon, but I know my cholesterol's up. My doctor said I should have some cholesterol, so maybe I'll have like some, you know, shredded wheat. But shredded wheat doesn't taste that good, but maybe I'll put a little sugar on it, but the sugar's not good for me either, because I got, you know, I got the high blood sugar, I'll get diabetes. And you think, and you wonder, like, okay, let's, what, who's this made by? Oh, you know, Post Cereal. So what's their, yeah, how do they treat their employees, you know? Do they oppress third world workers? So you just kind of go on forever, right? You think about all the different implications of what you do every day. Should I use cow's milk, right? How are those dairy cows treated? Not very well. Should I try to get some organic milk? Hey, I heard that raw milk stuff's supposed to be good for you, have all these enzymes. But then the government tells me I'll get some horrible infection and die, and tells me raw milk's unsafe. I better do some research on the internet. Pretty soon, holy cow, I'm gonna be late for class, right? So you spend the whole day spinning your wheels trying to figure out, well, you should drink raw milk or soy milk. You say, oh, I heard soy is good for you and it's supposed to be good for your heart, but then so I read someplace that it mimics estrogen, so I'm gonna I'm gonna lose my virility, and maybe I should try this almond milk, you know, and just like go back and forth. The soy milk kind of costs more, right? So you got to pay more. But, you know, you're not harming cows. So you just go on and on and on. And meanwhile, you don't get anything done. So now I think the utilitarians have a good answer to this. And they'll say, so another objection, actually, we'll get to, do I have that on there? I don't think I have the response here yet. So what's an answer to this about this idea that it takes too long to calculate? Good objection? Bad objection?
The rules of thumb?
Rules of thumb, right. So what's a rule of thumb?
Where you just kind of have some rules that can be broken as necessary. They're kind of just general guidelines. And if it gets real complicated, you just want to look way down the road and try to make the decision based on the long term that fit within these rules of thumb.
Yeah, so a rule of thumb is just like a general guideline. So the idea is that you don't follow the rules legalistically or meticulously. You just follow them as needed. So like maybe my rule is try to eat healthy most of the time, right? Every once in a while I'll treat myself, but the rest of the time I'm going to eat like healthy. And maybe I think, I make a judgment on like, well, I looked at, you know, maybe I took a tour of a dairy. I'm like, oh, I don't want to, like, I feel really bad about the way these cows are treated. And maybe I read like one book that talks about how cancer is really low in China because they don't use dairy products. So I'm like, well, I'll eat this almond milk because it's 40 calories a serving and it tastes pretty good, right? And maybe I'll think I'll just like buy cereal with, you know, fiber in it and stuff that I like. So I'll go to Happy Meal and I'll get some like frosted mini wheats. And then maybe my rule of thumb will be, unless I wake up late or I'm running late, I won't eat breakfast in the cafeteria because I know generally it's just bad for me. And it's not like I have to maximize my choice, because part of maximizing my choice on every occasion is going to keep me from maximizing my life. Right? If I'm always trying to micromanage, I'll be like, you know, Jimmy Carter. For those of you that don't remember the Carter presidency, you know, Jimmy Carter was a very, very smart man. He's a farmer. He had a PhD in nuclear physics, I think. And so he was a very smart man, but he tried to micromanage every single decision. And because of that, his presidency was a complete disaster. What are the reasons? And so if you try to micromanage your life and try to have the best in every single decision, I have to watch myself for this. I try to like buy a new camera. You'd spend 6 months trying to research the perfect camera, and then you go on vacation, you don't have a camera at all, right? And so, you know, trying to save like the extra dime at the grocery store when something's on sale, and it's just it doesn't make any sense. So the idea is you just follow general rules of thumb, and then when you have like a weighty decision, one that really matters a lot, then you can kind of focus a lot of time on it, like, who you're getting married to, where you're going to go to school, what your major's going to be, what you're going to do for a living, and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Couldn't you also, in your spare time, work out ahead of time what you're going to do, like with breakfast, for example? Like, oh, you might be worried about it, but save it for later, do what you got to do, cook up an egg and bacon, and then work it out when you have spare time. And
right.
Create a rule set.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point, that you don't have to like always decide and research like right at the moment. You can save it for later. That's what I do a lot of. Like I make myself a note, like research whatever it is. I hear something, some health thing or some gadget that I need or so on and so on and so forth. So there's another argument that it turns people into unfeeling, calculating machines, beholden to the results of the hedonistic calculus. And so the idea is that you're not your own person, you're just sort of, you know, pleasure, you know, you're looking for your next pleasure fix, and you're like, okay, calculate how much pleasure will this produce, perform this action, and you're kind of robotic. And Mill's writing the Industrial Revolution, so this kind of worries about individual human beings being dehumanized by mass production and mass culture is starting to become a worry. And here, Mill says, you know, it's okay to feel and be an individual, but the idea is to use your reason to figure out what's going to make you the happiest. And then, you know, do that, and your feeling is going to motivate you to do the right thing. So you use your reason to figure out what the right thing to do is, and then your emotions sort of carry you over. So, like, you use your reason to figure out, oh, spending all my money buying jewelry and fancy clothes and a bunch of gadgets that I don't use and living in a big house that I can't even fill up and fill up with a bunch of useless junk, then maybe that's not producing as much happiness as, like, helping starving people in third world countries. And then it's your compassion that might drive you to follow through on that, to maybe sell some of your junk and give a little money of your money away to the poor. He says people say it's a godless doctrine. And for that, Mill says, look, doesn't God want us to be happy? So if God wants happiness for his creatures, he says utilitarianism is the most profoundly religious doctrine there is, namely that we should be concerned with the happiness of mankind. And what could be more religious than that? Finally, there's this dirty hands objection. And this is the idea that utilitarianism requires you to sully your hands, to get down and dirty and do some really rotten things for the greater good. So there's a couple of scenarios in the back of the back of this chapter. I mean, one where you have to take a job at a bioweapons factory producing biological weapons, you know, which have the potential to kill millions of people and get out of control and kill millions more. And the idea is that you might be obligated to take that job doing something really bad. Why? Because if you don't do it, somebody else is going to do it and do a better job and create worse consequences. So the idea is, like, to get on and sort of drag your feet and be an incompetent and keep the program from advancing. And it might be your obligation to do that. Or probably a stronger example is the example of the third world assassination. So the idea is you're in some sort of Central American dictatorship, maybe like the former Panama or Nicaragua or someplace where you have some corrupt general, and he says, as a foreigner, you're going to be honored here. If you kill one of these peasants, I'm going to let the other 9 go, or maybe the other 10 go. 11, I think he's got 10. So there's 10, he's going to shoot all 10 of these peasants because there's been a recent uprising or insurrection or something. And so he says, I'm going to kill all 10, but because you, my honored guests, are here, I will allow you to pick one to die. And you're going to have to shoot him yourself, and then I'll let the other 9 go. So if you were given that choice, what would you do? To kill one and 9 live. If you do nothing, all 10 will die.
Take the gun and shoot the general.
Okay, suppose that's going to result in you die and to get down 11. You're going to be shot because the general's not stupid, right? So he's got his men. They're all pointing their guns at you. If you try to turn around the general, you're going to be shot before you can even turn around. So he's gives you one bullet and he gets a pistol, right? Maybe he's got a vest on or something. Maybe he's standing a ways away, right? So you're not going to be able to shoot the general. You might wing one of his men, but then you're going to die. So,
good utilitarian, you shoot the one to save the 9.
Yeah, how would you pick who you're going to shoot?
Ask for volunteers.
yeah, I suppose, right? Or you might, like, look at this, somebody's, like, crippled or, you know, maybe old, right? An old person. Maybe somebody's really ugly. Somebody that looks kind of grizzled and, like, they've had a bad life. So you'd, and you'd have to kind of guess, right? You try to pick the least valuable person and shoot that person to save the other nine as a utilitarian. Well, the objection to this is that any moral theory that says you're morally required to commit murder and to sort of pick the weakest and saddest sack of the bunch and kill him is, you know, something's got to be wrong with it. That morality can't require you to participate in the evil scheme of someone else. And that if you refuse, you've done nothing wrong because you're refusing to commit an act of murder. And that is not your responsibility that those people die, right? That's all on the general. It's his fault that all the people die. He's the one committing the murder. If you don't participate, you have no responsibility in the matter. Utilitarianism would say it's always your responsibility. That you can't put your squeamishness ahead of the greater good. That you're always required to act for the greater good, even if it means getting your hands dirty. And I think that's it. Okay, so that's it for today. We're going to finish up utilitarianism on Wednesday. And I think a review for our next exam. See you guys then. Happy Halloween.
I'm all convicted about what I hand out.